I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In a split decision, Delaware's Supreme Court rules that the state's death penalty violates the U.S. Constitution. WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports.
The High Court says Delaware's death penalty violates the Sixth Amendment guarantee to a trial by a jury. The state Supreme Court ruling follows one from the U.S. Supreme Court that overturned Florida's death penalty because it allowed judges to impose a death sentence. In their opinion, justices wrote that the Delaware death penalty statute is unconstitutional because it does not require jurors to be unanimous. The decision is a victory for death penalty opponents who had been unsuccessful in getting state lawmakers to repeal Delaware's capital punishment statute, despite vocal demonstrations inside and outside Legislative Hall in Dover. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Monsignor William Lynn, the first Catholic Church official to be convicted of covering up sex abuse by clergy, will wait for a new trial at home after being released on bail today. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court recently affirmed a lower court ruling that Lynch's sentence should be vacated because jurors were prejudiced by hearing evidence about clergy sex abuse unrelated to Lynn's actions. Details from WHYY's Aaron Moselle.
Lynn's conviction in 2012 was a big deal, a landmark decision. Brian Rowe covered the three-month case for the National Catholic Reporter. He says until then, priests had only been convicted for committing abuse, not for being in charge of the abusers.
Lynn was the Secretary of Clergy for the Archdiocese, and it was his role to monitor priests. He was also the one who had allegations that would have come across his desk. In that role, the prosecutors argued that it was his responsibility to act on these allegations if they did come forward and to report those to the police, and they said that he didn't do enough in that respect.
Lynn was handed a 3 to 6 year sentence, served 33 months, and was scheduled for parole in October. Assistant District Attorney Brian Zarallo says it's still worth retrying the case, even though another conviction might only send Lynn to prison for a few months.
This level of institutional sexual abuse and the cover-up that ensued is something that where the victims deserve justice and the people of the Commonwealth deserve to delve into this and have this matter come to a conclusion that is in accordance with the law.
Zarallo's boss, District Attorney Seth Williams, added in a statement that he will, quote, continue to use every available legal option at my disposal to prosecute pedophile priests and those who shield them to the fullest extent of the law. The move drew applause from SNAP, the survivors network of those abused by priests. The group says another trial will deter others from covering up abuse. Defense Attorney Thomas Bergstrom says Williams is misguided, but he's ready to defend Lynn again.
It's pretty clear that he was a scapegoat for others, and he remains so. But you know, if we're going to try the case, we'll retry it.
If convicted, Bergstrom says Lynn can't be given a longer sentence. The Archdiocese of Philadelphia declined comment. Lynn, who was not in court for this proceeding, is scheduled to appear later this week after posting $25,000 bail. The next trial is expected to start sometime in 2017. I'm Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
The Washington State Attorney General is suing Comcast for more than $100 million, claiming the Philadelphia company deceived customers about its repair plans. Details from WHYY's Todd Bookman.
For an extra $5 a month, Comcast offers a service protection plan that's supposed to cover repairs for issues including in-home wiring. In marketing materials, the company calls its service, quote, comprehensive. But a new lawsuit alleges the country's largest cable provider misled customers about what the monthly service plan actually covers.
This case is a classic example of a big corporation systematically deceiving Washington State consumers and putting profits above those customers and the law.
This is Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson speaking at a press conference. He calls Comcast's protection plan nearly worthless.
Contrary to Comcast's claims that the plan provides comprehensive coverage, it covers only a narrow scope of repairs.
Ferguson says more than 500,000 of his state's residents were duped, and that in offering the service, Comcast sales representatives used scripts that didn't disclose the plan's limitations. The lawsuit also claims that Comcast improperly charged other service fees and performed unnecessary credit checks. In a statement, Comcast says its service plan completely covers more than 99% of repair calls. It adds that it stands behind its products and services and that the company will vigorously defend itself. It's unclear if other states will follow in Washington's footsteps. The Pennsylvania Attorney General's office says it is aware of the lawsuit. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
2 years ago, New Jersey implemented the PARC Assessment System, Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers, annual year-end tests in English language arts, literacy, and math exams in grades 3 through 8 and high school. Governor Chris Christie conducted a press conference today to tout results to date.
So I'm pleased to report that the preliminary results for the 2015-16 school year show positive gains in math and English language arts. So what's that mean exactly?
Well, to find out what that means, let's turn to John Mooney, education writer and founding editor of NJ Spotlight. John, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Hi, Dave.
John, Chris Christie says it means that a higher percentage of students met or exceeded expectations. Yes?
Yeah, this is the second year of the test, a pretty radically different test for New Jersey. There had been a considerable drop in results from the previous test last year when we did it for the first time, and they ticked up a little bit in the second try. I mean, this was somewhat expected and not huge changes, but certainly more kids were doing better on the test. He also used the opportunity to talk about how more kids took the test. 2 years ago, there had been, you know, some fairly significant numbers of kids who opted out of the test, somewhat in protest of it. And those numbers also dropped significantly. It was good news, at least from his point of view, on the state of testing in New Jersey.
The assessment system also includes instructional tools for teachers. How is that cohort responding 2 years in?
The union, NJEA, especially the New Jersey Education Association, had been vociferously against the PARC testing in that first year and spent a lot of money advertising against it. Though not necessarily pressing the for kids to opt out, they certainly weren't discouraging it, at least as an organization. They're coming around. I wouldn't say there's a lot of support for testing in New Jersey by any means, and there's certainly lots of questions about using these tests, both in judging students as well as judging teachers, but we are starting to get used to them a little bit more, and so you don't quite have the passion we had that first year.
Did the governor also use the opportunity to expand on his plan to equalize funding across the state?
Well, I asked him about that, and one of my questions for him is if indeed schools are improving, including urban schools, does that run counter to a pretty significant narrative in his school fairness plan that urban districts especially are not doing very well? And he came back that it's not contradictory at all, and in fact, and he's, I'm sure, right, though they didn't release district-by-district scores, but the gaps remain significant. But schools, you know, at least by this measure, appear to be improving, and whether they should then be followed up with, you know, steep state aid cuts is also something I asked him about. And he's sticking to it, and from what I can tell, there's not a whole lot of political support for it, at least in the legislature, but it is, as one Democrat said, political red meat for folks, and he does find some receptive audiences, for sure.
So then is there support for Senate President Steve Sweeney's proposal? He's also looking into devising a more equitable funding system.
Yeah, his is significantly less rash and largely would make some adjustments in the existing formula as opposed to blowing it up. And I think he has more support among Democrats, certainly, and even maybe some Republicans. But whether he has enough support to override a veto of the governors, or if they work together on something. The governor today said, stay tuned. You know, there's a lot of time to talk about it. And he even put a time frame going into next summer. So he's not letting up.
Well, as you cite next summer, let's fold politics in. Of course, Sweeney is a Democratic front runner for governor next year.
Yeah, there's no doubt that there's a few things in play, and part of the peril of his plan is a more drawn-out plan where there would be a commission that would come up with recommendations that the legislature would have to vote up or down on in terms of revising the formula. And that commission would be working for about a year, and that's starting to put them right into the middle of the gubernatorial election. And I wonder if much is going to get done next fall, that is the fall of 2017, with all eyes on New Jersey's governor's seat.
Meanwhile, I understand the State Board of Education is scheduled to meet tomorrow.
And that's another somewhat unresolved debate. They're to meet and take final action on some high school graduation requirements, which would be tied to the PARC test starting with the class of 2021. In that case, to graduate, you'd have to pass the Algebra 1 math test and the 10th grade language arts test as one of the requirements for graduation. But the state board, which has been holding hearings on it and discussing it for several months now, is going to do the final adoption, but their president has been quite clear in saying, you know, we have 5 years to see this sort of roll out, and we'll be watching it closely. And if indeed we see some real obstacles for a lot of kids not to be able to graduate, we're going to, you know, maybe we'll have to rethink some of it.
John, as always, thanks for taking us to school.
Thank you, Dave.
John Mooney, education writer and founding editor of NJ Spotlight. Still ahead this evening, students may be uncomfortable with potential changes in the Erie, Pennsylvania school district.
I'd feel like an outcast because of my skin color, because I'm black, and everybody that goes there is pretty much white.
We'll look at challenges some students in Erie may face when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Parking in the middle of Broad Street in South Philadelphia was banned for 4 days over the Democratic National Convention, and now some want to keep it that way. There's a resident petition gaining traction to permanently eliminate the South Philly tradition. But as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, many who live along Broad Street are not ready to see the practice end.
Walking his dog down South Broad, George Van Sciver says the subject comes up a lot, especially when he's hosting friends from other cities.
Many out-of-towners say, what on earth is this craziness with cars in the middle of Broad Street? And I say, that's South Philly.
Single-file cars parked in the middle of South Broad is technically illegal, but the parking authority and city officials haven't enforced the rule in decades. Mike Messina, who has worked at a funeral home on Broad for 45 years, likes it that way.
It's part of South Philadelphia. We park crazy down here.
Here's where Jack Leifer steps in. He's with a political action committee called Fifth Square. He thinks that using the median lane of one of the busiest streets in the city as a parking lot is a bad idea.
So we see a lot of crashes occur, whether it's a pedestrian that crosses and a car doesn't see them because of a parked car, or because someone's opening their car door and there's a 35 mile an hour car going past.
I mean, I don't see a safety problem. There's always goofballs that'll try and make a U-turn anyway, so.
Messina says nobody would be able to find a space if the middle of the road parking went away, but Leifer's group says the DNC was a good test. The median parking was banned and the sky didn't fall. After putting letters in a mailbox at Broad and Reed, Ann Matei says parking during the convention was tough.
For 4 days, I did not move my car because I was afraid to move that, to lose that parking space. For 4 days, we were prisoners. They don't understand.
The issue has been fiercely controversial for decades. In 1961, Mayor Richard Dilworth proposed a South Philly parking plan that would have gotten rid of the median parking. According to an account from the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin, a near riot ensued. The mayor was greeted with thousands of angry residents who pelted him with rocks. An officer guarding the mayor was struck in the head with a glass milk bottle. An attendee said the mayor, quote, better get out of here before somebody gets killed. This was over South Philly parking regulations. Asked about scraping the tradition, current Mayor Jim Kenney said not anytime soon.
I know it's an anomaly for many neighbors to see that.
Kenny's a South Philly native, so he knows how entrenched the custom is. Still, his office confirms that conversations with the community have started about potentially removing the mid-street parking.
It's never happened, and I can't imagine Jim Kenney changing it either.
Murray Dubin is a former Inquirer reporter who wrote a book about South Philly. He says it's just one of those things that no mayor has been willing to touch.
They feel like it's almost a right that's been grandfathered. They feel like it doesn't cost the city money. It's something they need. And the sense is, why are you messing with my life?
How did this even start? Nobody knows for sure, but Dubin thinks sometime after World War II, funeral attendees started parking in the median.
Because the funeral homes had nowhere to park for the people going to the funerals, and it just continued.
Leifer with the Urban Policy Pack says in a 5-block radius on Broad, there are 20,000 parking spaces. The median parking creates just 200 additional ones. He's gotten more than 1,000 people to sign a petition asking the mayor to restrict parking in the middle of Broad. As a guy who would only be identified as Sal pulled into the median, he said there's just too many cars in South Philly. He definitely won't be signing the petition.
If it's too congested in the parking spots, then people are banging your bumper and they try to squeeze in.
Then there's Ed Birkenhauer, who was walking along Broad Street. He said he's ready to put his name down.
Because it's too much. Yeah, I got traffic. You got saying you can't get around people. You got people coming through the cars. You got to watch out for everything. You got kids coming through there.
Birkenhauer, though, is from North Philadelphia. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
In the face of systemically inequitable state funding, the superintendent of Erie Public Schools has proposed shutting down all city high schools, instead sending students to the better-resourced suburban districts. As Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCory reports, it would amount to a major race and class integration effort.
In the waning days of the school year, a group of students at Strong Vincent High School sat around a large wooden table in the library, talking about how they feel their school is perceived out in the suburbs. Nathan Stevens, a white junior, was one of the first to chime in.
We're a city school, and the surrounding districts are higher income, and they always think that they're better than us. That's just how it works around here.
Whitney Henderson, an African-American sophomore, spoke next.
Everybody thinks that it's a ghetto school, or that the people that go here are dumb or, bad.
Yeah. Based on what?
Yeah, stereotypes.
This conversation has become especially pertinent as the city district studies the possibility of closing all of its high schools and busing students to the surrounding districts. Superintendent Jay Badhams has floated this idea as a way to ensure that the kids get a fair education in the midst of chronic budget shortfalls.
We're taking away from students who already have fewer opportunities than their peers in surrounding school districts here in Erie County. So for us, this is as much an equity issue as it is a financial issue.
But the proposal has made waves, and the racial and socioeconomic math is hard to ignore. Erie is by far the poorest district in the county, and 57% of its students are minorities. No other district in the area exceeds 12%. It's a dynamic that Erie City students know well. Again, Whitney Henderson, who here references one suburban district and another suburban high school.
If I went to Harbor Creek or if I went to McDowell, I'd feel like an outcast because of my skin color, because I'm black, and everybody that goes there is pretty much white.
In a cozy coffee shop in suburban Erie, Mill Creek School District mom Janine Mattern says she'd welcome the city students into her district, but acknowledges that's not the mindset of many others.
I get a little bit upset when I hear other parents that are against it totally because they don't want Erie City kids. Okay, well now you're almost trying to put a racial spin on it, and that to me is wrong.
The superintendent in Mill Creek has said much the same, but the topic has been the subject of vitriol on social media, where some parents have disparaged Erie students and parents. Interview requests with those posters went unanswered, and recent headlines of city violence likely aren't warming them to the idea. Those in the suburbs willing to speak against the closure plan point to logistical concerns. Thomas Pendleton is a Mill Creek parent worried about class size issues.
There really isn't the capacity in the neighboring school districts to absorb 3,200 students.
State Rep Kurt Sunny, a Republican who represents a slew of other outlying districts, also argues against it.
It's difficult on any student to have to bus them for miles to a strange new school with all new people. You know, it's tough.
But there are some who say that figuring out the logistics would actually be well worth the extra effort. Kimberly Quick is a policy associate at the Century Foundation, which advocates for school integration based on research that finds it's a major boon for low-income minorities.
If the outcomes and the benefits that a school can provide to the son of a janitor are tied to those to the son of a congressman, then they're more likely to get those resources, right?
The issue in Erie is even more complicated because of Pennsylvania's education funding policies, which have largely ignored the actual needs of students for the past 25 years. So although Erie is one of the state's most challenged districts, the state sends more money per pupil to most other districts in the county, wealthier ones that already have an easier time raising local funds.
The difference between the resources we have in the county compared to in here are just shocking.
Brian Polito is the chief financial officer for Erie Public Schools. Before, he held a similar position in a rural county district. To illustrate, he says, for instance, last year Erie spent $6,000 on its 18 libraries.
In the school district that I came from, which is just 12 miles down the road, We had three libraries, and our budget for library resources was almost $40,000.
The entire prospect, though, begs a larger racial question. Would state leaders work to more quickly rectify the state's odd funding logic if the districts most negatively affected were a different color? Would Erie's crisis even be happening if it was a majority white district? I pose that to Whitney Henderson and her best friend Dominique Booker, both sophomores at Strong Vincent. Whitney speaks first and references three of Erie's high schools.
I don't think it would. I don't think if the majority of students that went to SV or that went to East or Central, if they're white, there'd be this problem.
Dominique wants to have a more hopeful outlook.
I'm like, I don't think so, but then that just questions. But I really don't know. It's a really hard question because you look and they have like more money, they have better stuff. But I don't want to think that way.
Kevin McCory, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
I got a mule and her name is Sam. 15 miles on the Erie Canal. She's a good old worker and a good old pal.